Good morning. Potential changes in the relationship of the PUC to Hawaii's utility are among a group of energy bills we'll talk about today. Blue Planet Executive Director Jeff Michelina has a rundown of the bills his organization is eyeing, including the one that would limit solar energy in subdivided ag land. And if you're a regular contributor to your favorite nonprofit, philanthropy advocate Tracy Gary says you can do more with your money as you create a giving plan. She'll join us later this half hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook. Singers like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett still sound great to us, and Dana Land knows their secret. She'll be here with a preview of her weekend concert. And maybe the idea of bringing Theater of the Absurd to a kids' audience isn't so far-fetched after all. Mark Branner is the director of Noodle Doodle Box.
Good morning. Potential changes in the relationship of the PUC to Hawaii's utility are among a group of energy bills we'll talk about today. Blue Planet Executive Director Jeff Michelina has a rundown of the bills his organization is eyeing, including the one that would limit solar energy in subdivided ag land. And if you're a regular contributor to your favorite nonprofit, philanthropy advocate Tracy Gary says you can do more with your money as you create a giving plan. She'll join us later this half hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook. Singers like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett still sound great to us, and Dana Land knows their secret. She'll be here with a preview of her weekend concert. And maybe the idea of bringing Theater of the Absurd to a kids' audience isn't so far-fetched after all. Mark Branner is the director of Noodle Doodle Box.
Monday, February 22nd, those conversations and a few more coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Van.
Good morning, Beth Ann. People in Hawaii tend to be pretty generous as far as charitable giving, don't they?
Well, we believe that so, and according to some of the statistics that came out last year from the Hawaii Community Foundation, likely true.
Good.
Well, a very good thing, but then again, it can get better, and that's part of the subject of our first conversation this morning, because you know it feels good to give. If you believe that and followed up with charitable donations, you are already among the more than half of all Hawaii households which regularly give to nonprofits they have a relationship with. Now, that's according to the Hawaii Community Foundation's Hawaii Giving Study, and how you can maximize your gifts financially and emotionally is the subject of philanthropy advocate Tracy Gary's work. She'll be coming to Hawaii to speak to the Women's Fund of Hawaii. And we've got her on the phone with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I'm delighted to be with you all.
And glad to be talking to you as well. In all the work that you've done over roughly 40 years, you're really documenting the journey that people make from just feeling that they want to give in the moment, perhaps, to coming to a place of creating a planned giving strategy. Is that really a journey of maturity?
I don't know if it's as much maturity as it is our life experience of when we really feel moved by someone else or a cause. Sometimes, you know, people who are very, very poor just feel very strongly that they want to lift someone else even as they try to climb their way out of poverty. And it makes us feel wonderful. It makes us feel connected. And it makes us happier. And, in fact, giving and volunteering helps us to live longer. Studies have shown that.
You bring up the point that being a donor and perhaps being a philanthropist are often the same thing, regardless of socioeconomic background. Is that really, you know, the point of it, that by making a plan of strategy that you're really becoming a philanthropist at whatever level?
Well, I think that we have, as you do in Hawaii here, 50 In on the mainland, maybe it's 60% of all Americans are making regularly household donations to nonprofits. Most people don't like the word philanthropy because it sounds like a very big word, but people give, they're generous, and they're donors or they're philanthropist. A philanthropist is someone who tries to be a little more intentional about how they're giving, and having a plan, a plan for how, what you give during your lifetime or beyond, during your legacy, is usually part of the philanthropist's journey. And I help people with that kind of intentionality. But so do the Hawaii Community Foundation, so does the Women's Fund of Hawaii. And we're all doing a certain amount of donor education to figure out, gee, what are the problems, what are the issues, what are some of the solutions for the good people of Hawaii or working nationally or internationally.
So really,
there are over 5,600 nonprofits here in the Hawaiian Islands themselves.
Right, and we also, many of us, you know, who live here feel pulled in one direction or another, which kind of goes back to the idea of aligning your own values with what it is you're trying to do with your money and not just feeling perhaps pulled in the moment to be able to take that intentionality and maximize it. Would that be true?
That's definitely true. I mean, a question I love to ask people is, what do you want to change or preserve during your lifetime or beyond? Because some people are business people, and they feel like, gee, if I have extra money, I'm gonna give someone a job. And they might want to leave part of their business to the Women's Fund of Hawaii or to the Hawaii Community Foundation when they die, or friends and family. Of course, we always try to help friends and family. But, you know, you've got wonderful over 5,000 nonprofits. You know, about 15% of them are serve the arts here in Hawaii, about 17% serve education. About 6%, or almost twice as much as we do in the mainland, actually goes to the environment, of course, because you're in such a beautiful, beautiful area. Human services get about 30%. Religion gets about 4%. That figure is also very interesting because on the mainland, about 30% of every dollar that's given to charity is given to religion, and here on the islands, it's 4%. So we care about a lot of different things, and we're deeply concerned also about the state of education and the gap between the rich and the poor. So a lot of people's mental health, for instance, on the islands gets about 12% of every dollar that's given. And so we know there's lots of issues and lots of causes. And I think for many of us, we say, gee, I'm an environmentalist, but we may be driving an SUV. We may be invested in an oil stock. And so we're not always in alignment between what our stated values are and what we really want to see happen in the world. And what I find is when people get into that greater alignment, sometimes by just attending a workshop and kind of going, oh, wow, I'm not really walking my talk or living my values, then we feel better. And we feel, wow, this can make a change.
Tracy Gary, as you look at people who may be just starting that journey, they're already giving, but they're looking at perhaps being more greatly focused on that intentionality, what would be the first thing that you would ask them to do in considering their values and how well or how, you know, little they sync with how they're giving?
Well, the first thing I've asked them to think about is, first of all, what's the first time you remember actually seeing an injustice or something that really troubled you? It could have been yesterday. It could have been in your childhood. And just the feelings around seeing that injustice and that sense of, can you do something about it? Do you want to do something about it? And the other thing is to think about who's been generous with you in your life and how did that feel when somebody gave you something? And, you know, how do you feel now when you do write a check or you help an organization? Are we allowing ourselves to feel the really good things, or are we buying into the fear that seems to be around us of, gee, the economy is going to tank or taxes are going to be too high or all the fear that happens in a lot of them? With all due respect to NPR, the media around us is often giving the negative reports, not so much the outstanding work that's being done, for instance, by the Women's Fund of Hawaii for women and girls to strengthen women and girls in our communities and all over the world. We're seeing wonderful progress in some areas. So I ask people to really focus on what's working and how do we build on what's working. What are some of the things that you really have loved giving to during your lifetime? For instance, some people get enormous satisfaction. You know, over 15% of all the nonprofits in Hawaii are arts organizations. And when I ask people, gee, draw a pie chart of, for instance, you have these three values, which might be community, respect for elders, and youth. Is there any way that you, in your giving, could be thinking about how that would be reflected? Well, some people may go, gee, I want to fund the senior center. I'd like to get youth doing some volunteering at that senior center. and maybe they could draw a mural or create an art project, because I love the arts, working at a local center. So when people take their values and then we ask them to look and get help to find organizations that are manifesting those missions or values, there's such a high for people. They feel like, gee, I don't have to do this alone. There are lots of people who care as I do.
You're really talking about mindful giving, and that's what you're encouraging us to do. And I know we'll hear more from you later this week when you're speaking in Honolulu. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, and I hope everyone will have a giving plan, because it's so much fun to work from that plan and feel hopeful about the state of the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Tracy Gary is the project co-director for Unleashing Generosity and has been a philanthropic advisor for 40 years. Her book is Inspired Philanthropy, Your Step-by-Step Guide to Creating a Giving Plan and Leaving a Legacy. She'll be speaking at a Women's Fund of Hawaii event in Honolulu this week, and you can find out more on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It is 8:14. Coming up, vocalist Dana Land with a preview of her weekend concert. But first, your quiz.
In this morning's backyard quiz, a walk in your garden. And if you have one, you may well have some of the plants we're spotlighting this morning. They're some of the most beautiful flowering plants found in Hawaii. And as with so many popular garden plants in the islands, this one is not native. It comes from the subtropical coasts of southern Africa, and these days is found in warm weather climates around the world. Its flowering head looks like a bird's, complete with beak and plumage. Nudge, nudge, hint, hint. And that resemblance gives it its name, or names, that we're looking for this morning. It's a hardy plant, a slow-growing evergreen perennial that thrives in direct sunlight and can grow in salty soil. It's ideal growing conditions, according to the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, is rich soil with good drainage. CTAR has this advice for gardeners. Liberal watering during the winter will encourage it to grow more profusely and ensure good flowering production during the summer months. Dead flowers should be pruned periodically. Now, with that bit of free gardening advice, we're looking for the name of this popular flower. Call us if you know it, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right, which should be pretty easy this morning. Heck, it's a Monday. Well, you'll get the T-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting the traditional Irish instrumental music of Lunasa with Tim O'Brien, 7:30 p.m., Thursday, March 10th. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
There's no doubt that the art of the crooner had a golden age, one that, sadly, we're no longer in. Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, and their peers have always been great storytellers who had great songs to work with. And it's tempting to say we don't see their like again, but luckily we have singers like Dana Land who know where these folks were coming from and have the skills and understanding of the music to bring it to life. Dana's performing at our Atherton studio this weekend, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning.
You've always loved this kind of music, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. This is the music that I perform all the time, popular jazz.
And it doesn't really get old. I mean, you know, a lot of these songs were recorded in the 50s and the 60s, right?
Right. No, to me, and that's why we're doing the concert, is to highlight these legendary crooners that we've all come to know and love, mm-hmm. and the songs that they recorded that have stood the test of time and endured the years. And they're all, you know, so fun to perform, like Mambo Italiano and The Best Is Yet to Come and Stepping Out with My Baby, that old Black Magic. Fly me to the moon, mm-hmm. you know, out on the plains, down near Santa Fe. You know, so, I mean, just so many fabulous tunes. And with a great band, there is no holding me back.
Well, nobody wants to hold you back. That's the point, right?
Well, I'm delighted to be doing this show here at my favorite venue here at Atherton Studio. So thrilled about that, and we look forward to having a nice full crowd.
One of the things that these singers that you're talking about, and you're talking about Sinatra and Mel Torme and Tony Bennett, one of the things that they all seem to have was access to great songs that had that were in themselves little plays, because I see you as having a lot of theater in your work. Accurate to say?
I would say so, yeah. You know, bringing the song to life is important, mm-hmm. and, you know, communicating the feel, the emotion of the song that's appropriate, I think is, yeah, definitely important as an entertainer. Yeah. I'll be doing a tune that was actually written by Mel Torme for his moon-themed album back in the early 60s called Swingin' on the Moon, and the lyrics are just so fabulous. And it's one of those hidden gems.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to perform that and bring it to people's attention is definitely one of the things that I love to do.
All the songs on that album have the moon in them?
Yes, yes. How High the Moon, Don't Let the Moon Get Away, Yellow Moon, yeah.
Just that old Devil Moon, I hope.
I'm not sure if that one is on there. It should be.
That'd be a good song for you, you know. That's a great song.
I actually recorded that on my first CD.
You did.
I did. And in fact, our darling gal over there was just, that was the intro.
Oh, well,
yeah.
There you go.
It did as a Latin, kind of a Latin rhythm.
You know, we've got another year. I guess this is your second CD. I want to play a little excerpt from a song from Damn Yankees. Whatever Lola Wants, Lola Gets.
Okay. Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind.
That's a perfect example to me, Dana, of the kind of song you like, because that has to be as much acted as sung.
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
The whole you like that sultry vibe, right?
I like every vibe. I love to do it all. I love humorous songs. I love straightforward songs. I love, you know, funk songs. I mean, I really do love to do it all. And I do love to have the audience join me as well on a couple of tunes. So that will be part of the program on
Saturday. What's a good tune for an audience to get the audience to get over its self-consciousness and join in with you?
Yeah, well, I love Cab Calloway's Heidi Ho Man, because it's the perfect call and response tune.
That it is.
Right? And it's fun, and it's easy for the audience to sound great and to be, you know, part of the whole package of fun.
Do your audiences, do they come to your shows pretty familiar with this material? I mean, some of it is more familiar than others. Some songs more familiar than others, yeah.
I think most of them do. Yeah, most of them are jazz lovers who kind of seek it out. You know, we don't have a lot of venues on this island that are offering great jazz. So, you know, our audience is small, but they're mighty. So they do tend to show up at the concerts.
Yeah, we probably have a lot more skilled jazz players than we do have places for them to perform.
Sadly true. Sadly true.
But I think you're absolutely right about the jazz audience being exceptionally loyal.
Yes, definitely.
Because they just know how precious this craft is.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I would love to see some children in the audience, actually. And in my promo, I've been encouraging, you know, families and moms and grandparents to bring young children. Because this is America's indigenous art form, and it's so creative, and it's so fun, and it's got that improvisational element.
Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, I have taken jazz presentations into the schools, and it's very important to get the kids, you know, aware of America's music.
And they take to it when you present it, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they get right into the groove of it. And, you know, of course, this umbrella of jazz is very wide, and we have a lot of different kinds of influences and rhythms that play into, you know, Dixieland jazz and funk jazz and straight ahead jazz and vocal jazz and bebop jazz. And I mean, it goes on. And so, it's such a fun, creative, expressive form of music that I'd love to see being taught in schools.
Someday, maybe.
Yeah.
And you do give me hope for the future, though, Dana.
Well, thank you, Chris. You're sweet.
Thanks
yes,
for coming
I will
in.
Carry the torch.
Please do.
There's a few of us doing it. And we're so, you know, with the Blue Note Club here now, I mean, this will just sort of elevate people's awareness, I think, of jazz, which is
so
fabulous.
So, yeah. Vocalist Dana Land will perform at HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday in a tribute to the songs of Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Dean Martin, Mel Torme, and Bobby Darin. She'll be accompanied by Tommy James on piano, Rocky Holmes on saxophone, flute and clarinet, Alika Lyman on bass, and Von Baron on drums.
Look around you, my people. If you look, then you will see how to love. Life is paradise, all together. What game shall we play today?
When the relics of the past become ideological eyesores.
Who are the people we can value as a society to create a more unified national identity?
Marble monuments and our common history, how we decide to build them and when we should tear them down. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Public radio is people. Our staff here in Hawaii, our broadcast colleagues across the nation and the world, our more than 200 program sponsors, and our approximately 13,000 members. Thank you to this group of individuals whose donations provide 65% of our annual budget. Please join us in acknowledging Lynn McCrory of Honolulu, Robin Earle of Kailua, and Elaine and Emily Kottenmeier of Kaneohe. As a listener, you're our kind of people, too. Let us hear from you in terms of support of Hawaii Public Radio. There's an easy online membership form at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda. Lawmakers and scientists are saying Hawaii might have gotten ahead of dengue and other mosquito-borne diseases with more preventative attention, but the reflection turns on why cuts to pest control happened in the first place. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair takes a look in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, as we keep hearing more about diseases like Zika and chikungunya, and obviously we've been coping with dengue, it's really tempting to go back and say, well, what happened and how come and all of that. But it turns out that, well, we've had cuts to pest control.
Well, our reporter Jessica Terrell has been reporting on exactly that, how there's been cutbacks, particularly in the vector control sector, which is it's kind of a catch-22, she says. When there's no epidemic, people at the legislature and others are looking and say, why are all these positions dedicated to fighting mosquitoes and vector control? Are they just sitting around doing nothing? And then when an epidemic actually comes back, which is the case right now on the west side of the Big Island, why aren't you doing something? How come there aren't more people staffed to do this? So Jessica, our photographer and our engagement editor, actually flew over to the Big Island last week. And what they found was that the reporting Jessica has done for Civil Beat is actually true on the ground there. There are not enough staff. The Department of Health is actually bringing in people from other islands. Hawaii County Civil Defense has been pulling workers from other positions. They are working at it as best they can. But it goes back to this fundamental question. Should you have cut those positions in the first place?
You're really talking about the ounce of prevention.
Exactly. And Jessica does take a look back historically at the three outbreaks we've had. And I didn't even know this. There was a dengue outbreak on Oahu back in 1944. That's, of course, during World War II. And the response to it was massive. Why? Well, because you needed the troops. You were at war, in this case with Japan. Then there was in 2001 on Maui, the state launched a very aggressive campaign. Some say too aggressive, might have turned off some tourists, but it worked. It was successful. But then in 2009, that's when the legislature started looking at those cuts at the Department of Health, essentially gutting the vector control team.
So at this point,
is that you need to have greater public awareness about how to combat mosquitoes on your own, not just rely on the government. So an on-the-ground report from Jessica and Civil Beat on fighting dengue, but there's still a lot of efforts to go. Even though the CDC has praised our efforts, there are residents and legislators in the area that say the state's response, the county's response, has been too slow and too small.
Which kind of goes to the bottom line of, although the government may be doing what it can, you're really responsible for yourself and your property.
Yeah, you never like government until you actually need it.
And in this case, maybe a little bit sooner than later. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, for all we hear about cholesterol, I'm not sure everybody completely understands it.
Well, you know what? Doctors don't either, so join the crowd. You know, we used to think that high cholesterol is really a direct risk factor and that cholesterol can cause blockages. And for all intents and purposes, that's true. But there are some interesting facts about cholesterol and heart disease. And some recent studies have shown that that really high HDL, that good cholesterol that we thought would protect folks, may not be as protective after all. So today we're going to talk about cholesterol and if it's really the implicator of blockages and what to do if you have high cholesterol. Should you take medication? Should you work on diet? Are there natural supplements? We're going to really try and demystify the cholesterol paradox.
Well, the traditional prescription, right, or the standard prescription is statins?
It is. And, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen that there are some risk factors that we didn't appreciate before with statins. In fact, sometimes they can actually increase blood sugar. So for those people whom you're trying to reduce the risk of stroke and heart attack, giving them diabetes is probably not in the right line of what you're trying to do. So, you know, we're going to talk about what are the rates of increased sugars with the statin medications. They're really good medicines, but they're not for everybody.
So you really need to diet would seem to be the most neutral course to follow.
Well, you know, it never hurts to follow a good, healthy diet. Mm-hmm. That may or may not be as effective as we would hope. And so we're really going to tease out today, what are these issues with cholesterol? How important is it to reduce cholesterol? And how do genetics play a role? Because they do, and it's something we haven't thought too much about in the past.
Well, I hope it's something that we all can get under control, yeah?
Well, let's do it before we eat cholesterol for dinner.
Fair enough. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and that's tonight at 5.
And now, while cholesterol may give you a bit of pause, something else that may cause you some angst, Hawaii's energy prices. Now, chafing over them isn't new, but what could affect the cost you may pay in future are some bills moving through the ledge that would make Hawaii's utility more responsive to the Public Utilities Commission. One bill would require the PUC to establish performance incentives, tying utility revenues to the utility's achievement of them. Another bill creates criteria for the PUC's methodology to determine the rate that a public utility should pay a producer for non-fossil fuel generated electricity supplied to the public utility. To have a look at these and other energy bills on his list, Jeff Michelina, the executive director of Blue Planet Foundation, joins us now. Hello there.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thanks
for
having me on.
Good. Would it be true to say that we're really looking at how lawmakers may change the shape of how the PUC and the public utility relate to each other?
That's true. And this happens every year at the legislature, where the legislature takes a hard look at the toolbox that the public utilities has to regulate the utility, sometimes providing new tools, sometimes taking things away, but trying to set the framework for how we regulate our energy providers in Hawaii.
As you look at this year's list, what things might be truly doable, things that might be feasible, and others that are just more reactionary and emblematic of the emotional upset that a lot of people feel toward the utility?
Well, a couple that we're fairly bullish on. Number one is building on what happened last year, which was the game-changing 100% renewable energy mandate for Hawaii, the first in the nation to have a 100% renewable energy requirement. We want to just tweak that definition somewhat to make it crystal clear that when we talk about 100% renewable, we're really talking about what most people think, which is zero fossil fuel. So there's a measure to do that, and also to look at if we do use natural gas in Hawaii, that all of this has to comply with our zero fossil fuel mandate by 2045. So that's House Bill 2291 and Senate Bill 2820 that would do that. The second measure is something that you had mentioned, setting up the performance-based rate making for the utility. This is something that we've been very excited about for a while because we think as soon as we can align the utility's incentive, how the utility makes money, with our clean energy goals and customer satisfaction and making sure people can do rooftop solar, it'll be a much smoother path for achieving our clean energy goals, and we'll have less resistance from the utility.
Now, the consumer advocate says that statutory language is unnecessary, that, you know, well, the PUC should be doing this anyway.
True, but it never hurts to have a nudge from elected lawmakers to make sure that we stay on track. And I think this is what it's intended to do, is reflect what the public wishes, what the public body, the legislature, wishes.
And what about the idea that there should be those incentive mechanisms that are directly tied to performance by the utility?
Exactly, and that's the intent of this measure, is to align those two. You know, currently we essentially reward the utility for building the system. They get a kind of a cost-plus contract. You build a power plant, some power lines, you get maybe 10% on top of that to recover from the customers. This would realign everything and say, you know, regardless of what you build, are you providing efficient service? Do you have high customer satisfaction? Are we integrating renewable energy? If so, they might be able to make more money than the current system.
But in the last week, we've watched what's been happening with HECO, sort of expanding coal and contracting solar. How feasible then would it be to say that this is what they would have to perform to, when clearly they seem to be moving in a different direction?
Well, I think that underscores the need for this measure. Is, you know, you see the utility reacting in ways that I think surprises most people in this new era of, you know, getting to a low-cost, low-carbon future. Why are we saying no to projects that are, you know, among the cheapest renewable energy? You know, 14-cent large-scale solar projects, you know, double the amount of solar on this island, while at the same time saying, look, we want to build a new fossil fuel power plant, and we want to expand the amount of coal that we use. A measure like this would make it crystal clear that that's not a profitable way forward for the utility. It's going to be more profitable to, you know, build the renewable energy, integrate, provide customer satisfaction.
Along those lines, there has been some talk about time of use and changing one's rate based upon when you're using electricity. One of the measures that's going to be heard today would ask that the utilities that use the time of use feature have a rate structure that would include eligible customer generation for any kind of net electricity produced during those peak hours, in terms of what would be then, you know, available back to the utility. given where we kind of see the utility moving, is this something that might be, you know, a nice idea, but at the wrong time, that there's just not going to be meeting up well? Or is it much more fuel for the fire?
This is a perfect time for this sort of measure. And this reflects just the changing grid that we have, utility grid. For the past 125 years, you know, it's pretty much a commodity that the utility provides. Things are changing now. People are generating their own power at home. We have over 70,000 rooftops with solar on them. The challenge is the solar comes in the middle of the day, and everyone comes home from work and turns things on, and the peak comes at night. So how do we better align that demand and that supply? And that's what the time of use rates would do. And to compensate folks differently for that power. You know, we recognize now that electrons are worth a different amount, you know, depending on the time of day, and that's what this would do.
Yeah, people who like to eat dinner and do laundry after dinner.
Yeah. Right, and that's probably going to cost a little bit more. But there's plenty of solutions out there, everything from, you know, facing the panels more west to battery storage. And so this is just a policy. The Public Utilities Commission is already looking at this, but again, really nudging them and providing them more tools to go quicker down that path to have time of use rates.
And before you go away, I want to talk about another bill that's going to be heard today. This one says that its purpose is to restrict solar energy facilities in residential housing areas in agricultural districts to have a capacity of no more than 25 kilowatts. That caused a great deal of a kerfuffle when it came out, saying, well, you know, that's an awfully small amount, and if you're starting to subdivide, you know, a few houses might do that. The next measure that came out, the update to it, removed the no more than 25 kilowatt capacity. So does that mean that it's a good idea?
Again, this is going through the conversation that the legislature has. I mean, we're fortunate to have this democratic, you know, body that gets to deliberate these things. As we discussed, some of it's theater and grandstanding. Some of it's our legitimate, you know, it's all a legitimate process to get to the policy framework that we want. You know, this measure came out of some concerned Hawaii Island residents who rightfully, you know, were concerned about the amount of solar that was going up around their agricultural subdivision. So, you know, some bills were introduced, conversation's been had, that's going through the process. We think it's a bit overreaching to really restrict down to a small 25 kilowatts. As you say, that's, you know, enough for maybe half a dozen homes. But again, going through the process and we'll see where it ends up. We hope that we have a, you know, a rational overarching, you know, policy that enables us to build solar in Hawaii, but also respects the concerns of the residents, make sure we do it in the right place.
Given the fact that we've watched oil plummet and people buying big cars and having sort of, I guess things are all right. Does that make it more difficult to push bills through like the ones that we're talking about this morning?
You know, we haven't seen that yet. We understand that that's happening on the mainland and elsewhere, and we do understand there's an uptick in people buying big cars. We are pretty myopic and don't always think long-term about these things. But I think the overall sentiment in Hawaii has changed. I think we understand that we're all on this course to a zero fossil fuel future, and we haven't seen a response from lawmakers that this is no longer important. Price goes down, the price is going to come up again.
A good thing to remember. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Beth.
Good to see you. Jeff Michelina is the executive director of Blue Planet Foundation. A list of the bills the organization has targeted and that we talked about this morning is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, it's not a native flower, but you'd never know it to see how prominently it's displayed in popular media as a symbol of paradise. It's a native of southern Africa with a distinctive look and beautiful coloration. The flower thrives in Hawaii, whose climate is similar. It does well in direct sunlight and doesn't mind a little salt in the soil. It takes 3 to 5 years to get a mature plant from seedlings, and a healthy plant can produce as many as 3 dozen flowers at a time. They look great in a vase, and here's a tip from the UH College of Tropical Agriculture. To prolong vase life, change the water every 2 days, trim an inch off the bottom of the stem with a sharp knife at each change. A trick of the trade is to cut the stem when it is submerged. This aids water uptake. That should keep your bird of paradise, sometimes known as a crane plant, looking great for about 2 weeks.
And that was the answer that we were looking for, either bird of paradise or crane plant. And Marcia Eckert from Kailua Kona knew that, called us, and yes, she says she has bird of paradise in her garden. Thanks very much for the call. You'll get the t-shirt. It's 8:45. If you've got a possible quiz for us, well, send that idea to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips for our report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in your morning sky from east to west as the morning goes on. Now, the moon this week is passing through its full moon phase, but as the week goes on, hopefully we'll see a return to nice dark skies.
Now, we have an interesting story today, which folks who listen to HBR News may have first heard last week in one of the Asia Minute reports. When you think about how things turned out with the 30-meter telescope so far, this story is an interesting one because it deals with a massive telescope project and how people are basically just being moved out of the way to create it.
That's right. So the situation surrounding the building of this telescope in China is drastically different from the situation that we have here in Hawaii. The telescope in China is 500 meters across. And unfortunately, even though this telescope is being constructed out in rural areas, it means 10,000 people will have to be displaced.
And so is there any protest about that? Or the government basically just moves in, takes 10,000 residents, and moves them out to put this thing up?
That is precisely what's happening. The situation in China is very, very different from here in the United States.
And this is not going to be an optical telescope like the TMT, right? This is a radio telescope.
Yeah, this is a huge radio dish. It's like a super-sized version of the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico. Now, in order to construct a telescope of such size, in this case half a kilometer, it has to be made up of many, many single segments, pretty much like the Keck telescope and the 30-meter telescope.
And they're moving all the folks out of there. Why?
They're actually moving the people to create a radio quiet zone. But in this case, we have to be conscious of the human cost of building such a massive facility.
And the Chinese, any reason as to what got them interested in doing this massive thing? I mean, is there a particular project that they're curious about, or do you think that it literally could have something to do with an interest in trying to listen for extraterrestrial life?
Well, China has been taking a very keen interest in upping their scientific game recently. As we know, they've sent spacecraft to the moon, they have a space station in orbit, and they're really starting to flex their muscle in science and technology.
Yeah, this thing sounds like something. So it'll be the biggest radio telescope on the planet?
Ever constructed.
Well, let's hope that if they find something out there, they'll share with us their discovery.
Let's hope.
It's Christopher Phillips, and thank you very much for the report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
The comedic duo, two clowns who know each other well and seem to have a constant battle going on between them, is a setup that offers a world of possibilities. It works for everyone from Laurel and Hardy to Vladimir and Estragon in Waiting for Godot. Director Mark Brenner has described the upcoming Hawaii Theater Center production of Noodle Doodlebox as Waiting for Godot, but for kids. The show's in rehearsals, and Mark's with us in our studio. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You know, I thought of Theater for the Absurd as something that would go over the heads of kids, but it's actually maybe more likely to reach kids than it is adults, do you think?
I think there's some truth to that, certainly. I think kids have an innate understanding of play, mm-hmm. which is really a big component of Theater of the Absurd. Mm-hmm. This particular piece is not exactly Theater of the Absurd, but there are certainly many references to Waiting for Godot and to Laurel and Hardy classic vaudeville clown shtick and duos.
And when you have the shtick between duos, sometimes they can really, you know, slap each other around and get almost hostile, but you know there's a bond always, don't you?
You know, the longest lasting partnership in children's television is Bert and Ernie, right?
Right.
And in a way, they're very much like a Laurel and Hardy duo. There's instantly a negotiation, a power struggle. You've got these personalities that want to be with each other, but they fight over little things.
Yeah.
And so that's a classic comedy bit that just keeps recycling, I think.
In a way, if both people in the duo agreed on everything, there would be no potential for conflict, no potential for theater, right?
Exactly right. And that's really one of the deep themes of this particular piece, is just the negotiation between friends and how to overcome differences and reach a point of appreciation of the other's differences.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two clowns, Zacharias and Pepper, in our production, are very much like those classic duos that stay together despite their differences.
Because a lot of longtime friendships that I can think of resemble comedy teams. Marriages, too. Right?
Marriages, exactly right. Great example.
Completing each other's sentences.
That's right. That's right.
Knowing each other's jokes so well that you kind of roll your eyes when you hear
that
kind of thing.
And I think kids really innately see that in the world around them. And so this is a production that certainly can play to the whole family, because there's so many references that you can see in different parts of our lives.
Well, I would also think that a lot of the kids in the audiences have a sibling
exactly
with whom
right.
they bicker.
It sounds just like my kids. I've got three.
Is that right?
I say, boy, my kids say the exact lines as these two. That's mine. Give it back.
Yeah, I'm
not going to be your friend anymore. You know.
Well, that's the other, as you say, I'm not going to be your friend anymore. That childhood is full of these apocalyptic pronouncements
that
are forgotten the next day.
Right. That's really what's wonderful about clown play, is the stakes are incredibly high, but oftentimes the clowns don't realize how simple the conflict actually is.
Yeah.
And the next day they're back doing the same thing.
Because you've studied clown play, you're really able to break it down into the components, like the way you just described it, right?
Yeah.
A conflict where the stakes are high,
right,
seem to be high.
Right. Everything is a massive importance, right? I've got to get that box. I've got to get that water, whatever the simple conflict is. Yeah.
When you were training as a clown, was that a big part of the training, that you're not supposed to know you're funny?
Oh, yeah. What happens on stage to you is of utmost importance. You never let on that this is funny. What's funny is that the stakes are so high and your investment in that desire is so strong. That's what makes it funny to the audience, because I think they recognize that in themselves, and it's like, oh, yeah, I do that.
You know, I think inexperienced performers can have trouble with the whole idea of being ridiculous on stage,
right,
and they want to sort of telegraph to the audience that I'm really cool in spite of the fact that I'm acting ridiculous,
right,
which ruins it. Yeah,
it does. It does indeed. We have really wonderful clowns in this production that just have a great innate sense of I am ridiculous and I own it. I love it. You know,
ridiculous in a very solemn way.
Right. Right. It's the child's belief in the truth of what's in front of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think that would be kind of a plateau to arrive at in your study of being a clown, that would be sort of you would reach a sort of a point of understanding when you got to that place in your own performance. Was it that way for you?
I think it's always a discovery. It's always a discovery, because we often have these voices in our head saying, no, don't be like that. Don't think like that. But it's that discovery on stage of saying, oh, I can't allow myself to feel that very simple emotion so strongly. I must have that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a constant discovery on stage, and that's what makes it very fun on stage, is because every show is very much out to the audience and alive in the moment.
And I would think that would be a particular demand of children's theater, and in a way there's a sort of a purity to the mind of children that would be almost like a higher challenge for a theater artist.
I think that's true in a way. I think a children's audience is very responsive. If they don't like something, I've had kids go, I'm bored, you know, and yawn in the middle of a show. And you feel terrible as a director. But that's an honest critique, right?
Yeah,
you know, no writer's ever going to say I was bored.
Yeah, right. And nobody has the nerve to say that when they're watching a Eugene O'Neill play.
Exactly. Oh, it's supposed to be good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the other thing, is that I'm wondering what happens to us as adults when we walk into a theater with all this sort of learned behavior about how you're supposed to respond to a play. You know,
right.
you can be in an O'Neill production and be bored out of your mind, but right. you would never admit it to
exactly.
anyone.
Exactly. No, I think the kids just come in with a fresh perspective of, well, what is it that I see? Oh, that's funny. Okay. And they start to get drawn into the story, hopefully, if it's done well. Whereas an adult audience would, okay, put up with it, clap politely, and never, you know, say it to your face.
Is it dicey to take kids to sort of a sad place? You know, do you not want them? Do they get too into it?
I think that really, you know, demeans the notion of what childhood is. Children experience loss just like adults. I think children know the truths of life in a much deeper way than we often give them credit for. And so I think plays that deal with hard things are really great to take kids to, because I think kids know. You know, they see it. They see it in their parents. They see it in their grandparents. They know that life can be hard at times.
And you might as well get that figured out
sooner rather than later. That's right.
Makes a lot of sense. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Mark Briner is an assistant professor and theater for young audiences director at UH Manoa. He's the guest director of Paul Maher's Noodle Doodle Box, which will be performed at the Hawaii Theater Center Saturday, March 5th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. and Sunday, March 6th at 2 p.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
On the next Fresh Air, as scientists struggle to understand and contain the Zika virus, we speak with science writer Sonia Shah about the troubling emergence of rapidly spreading diseases and the chances of an outbreak that could kill tens of millions. Her new book is Pandemic, tracking contagions from cholera to Ebola and beyond. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Bethann, you made a reference at the top of the show in your discussion of philanthropy to maximizing your gifts. What was the term you used? Financially and emotionally. Well, explain that for me, will you?
Well, most organizations know that it's not just their needs that they're talking about, but really the needs of the donor or the philanthropist to do something. And that comes from inside that person.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that you can maximize that, not just in the moment of, I feel good, here's $5 or $10, but looking at a plan for what you want to do with your money. What kind of legacy do you want to leave behind you? What's important to you? Those are the things that Tracy Gehry is particularly focusing on and asking us to look at when we're asked to give money.
Because obviously one of the biggest concerns when we give is, will maximum use be made of every penny? You know?
And you can check that. I mean, you can go onto different navigators, and Charity Navigator is certainly a good one. But beyond that, what is this going to do for you in the long term? And how is it that you want to see your money directed in your community or beyond?
But there's every reason to think of it in terms of its effect on yourself as well. Yeah.
Most people who donate do. That's the first consideration. That's going to do it for us for today. We hope you will consider coming back with us and being here tomorrow. We talk about real property tax reform in Kauai County, which could include a 3% assessment cap for homestead and long-term affordable rental properties. Kauai County Councilwoman Joanne Yoki Moore will be here.
And there will be a Hawaii visit from an inspirational author. And you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can find out lots of great things about the show on hpr2.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.